Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're starting in Syria with a story that feels unpredicted and unpredictable. Unpredicted because it's been a shock just how far and how fast rebel forces have advanced. Unpredictable because working out where this now leads is phenomenally difficult. At the very least in this programme, we'll try to ask some of the questions. A very brief recap. It was a few days ago that an alliance of rebel forces in the north of the country launched their offensive. They swept towards Aleppo, Syria's second city, which now remarkably appears to have fallen into their control. Or at least the forces of President Bashar al-Assad have melted away. They've also headed south towards the city of Hama. The Syrian civil war that had seemed stuck, frozen for so long, with Assad, most people thought, firmly with the upper hand. Well, that civil war feels like it has burst open again. And a reminder that it's a war which has, since 2011, seen hundreds of thousands killed, many millions displaced. First, let's get a look at the rebel group that seems to be leading the fight, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. It now controls Aleppo. Mina al-Lami is BBC Monitoring's jihadist analyst.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which means it's an acronym, and in Arabic it means the group for the liberation of Syria. And it's interesting, they use the term Hayat, which means more like a directorate, more of a neutral, mainstream-sounding name. So the group HTS, and I'll use the acronym HTS, has its roots in IS, or the Islamic State group, and al-Qaeda. So it has jihadist origins. It appeared in Syria in 2011. At the time, it was really an offshoot, secretively, it was an offshoot of IS in Iraq. And at the time, IS in Iraq was linked to al-Qaeda. But when IS emerged in Syria in 2013, it announced that Nusra Front, at the time as it was known, Nusra Front was part of IS. And so at that time, Nusra Front, which is the predecessor of HTS, they sought the assistance of a bigger group, which at the time was al-Qaeda, and they pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda, bypassing IS. So since 2013, Nusra Front became known as the branch of al-Qaeda in Syria. This was very problematic for Nusra Front because it presented itself as a Syrian group, because it really struggled to get support from the existing rebel groups at the time, the Free Syrian Army and other rebel groups, as well as Syrian people, the population in rebel-held areas, because it had the jihadist brand, because it had the al-Qaeda brand. So in 2016, Nusra Front announced very publicly that it was severing ties with al-Qaeda, with the parent group al-Qaeda. Observers, ourselves included, and we watch jihadist messaging, we thought it was a cosmetic change. It was simply a change of name, yet again, changing its name. But over the years, and you know, subsequent months and years, it seemed that the division between Nusra Front and al-Qaeda was genuine. So HTS started to fight al-Qaeda presence in Idlib. So HTS came to control most of Idlib province in northwestern Syria. And al-Qaeda at the time, so the members of al-Qaeda that were still in Nusra Front, they withdrew and they created their own group called Hurras al-Din, and they engaged in battles with HTS. Long story short, over the past couple of years, HTS has tried to really reinvent itself, not as a jihadist group, but as more of a moderate, so-called moderate militant group, always highlighting the term revolution and revolutionary, something that jihadists don't use, and distancing itself from jihadist terminology or Islamist terminology, like seeking to impose an Islamist rule or state. And one of the really important things they did, HTS did after it left al-Qaeda, was that in order not to present Idlib, which it controls in Syria, as a province that is controlled by jihadists or by militants, it created what it calls the Salvation Government. The Salvation Government became a front, a civilian arm, if you like, for HTS, so that the group was only kind of presented as just defending that area. But the body that is running it is, they presented it as a legitimate local authority. And the Salvation Government created ministries, or so-called ministries. So they have the minister, you know, Ministry of Health, of Communication, of Political Affairs, etc. And they are the ones always putting out really slick, they have a very slick media operation, again, to gain legitimacy. And they have been putting out loads of messages in the past years to the international community, to the West, to say, We have no global jihadist ambitions. We have no ambitions actually beyond Syria. We just want to, as they say, liberate Syria from the government of Bashar al-Assad.
Mina Alami from BBC Monitoring. Well, just before we came on air, we managed to get through to someone in Aleppo. He's a dentist. He asked that we not use his name on air. And you can hear in his voice the level of concern about what may now unfold. This is some of what he told me.
In Aleppo, we are all surprised. We don't know what happened. We were living our natural life, and suddenly we have an attack in a few days or in a few hours, about 24 hours. The Aleppo, the city is completely was full of militaries, the Free Army. They have controlled all the city. Now the civilian is very surprised and scared. We don't know what will be in the second 3 hours or days. The first hours after that, the army has attacked our city was a little safely. Now we are suffered from the airboat, our aircrafts. It's very dangerous, and a lot of civil people had died because of the air forces.
Right. So is your concern at the moment, is it principally about the people who are now in control of the city, or are you saying that you're actually more concerned about how the forces who are allied with the government, how they may respond, and in particular in terms of attacks from the air?
We have a bad experience about the army. The Syrian army and the Iran army is the more dangerous than the Free Army. We are, as a civilian, we know that. We know that the Free Army is more safe than the Syrian government army. We are very afraid from the air forces. Free Army are safe to the people, but the Syrian army or Iran or the Russian air force is the real danger.
Does that mean that people like you and others whom you know, are you just trying to stay safe, stay indoors, stay away from windows, all that sort of thing?
Of course, the people inside the houses are more safe than the people in the street. But the air forces now is attacking the hospitals, the centers of the government, and some places general places or general counters in the city. We don't know why, but the dangerous now is from the air forces only. The hospital of the Aleppo University today has been attacked. A rocket from a plane attacked the university hospital, and a lot of people was injured.
Given the fear I can hear in your voice, given the level of insecurity, can I ask, do you welcome the fact that rebel forces have entered Aleppo?
Yes. It's more safe than the government.
So you welcome the fact that they're there, even though you're saying that you're also very worried about what may happen now.
I'm not worried from the anti-government. I'm worried from the government and the Iranian and the Russian air forces.
A dentist in Aleppo, speaking to me just before we came on air. Well, Jérôme Drevon is senior analyst in jihad and modern conflict with the International Crisis Group. He's specialist on the war in Syria. Jérôme, very good to have you back on the programme. This rebel alliance that we've been talking about, I mean, led by this group HTS, it seems to have gone through something of a transformation. How serious and cohesive an alliance do you think it is?
They are much more cohesive than ever before. It can't really be compared to what we saw 10 years ago, where there were different rebel groups occasionally fighting one another, then uniting, then fighting again. Here, for the past 4 or 5 years, they've tried to professionalize, they tried to unite their military forces, increase professionalism, and their military efficiency. And the recent victories in Aleppo are a clear sign of that, a clear sign that they are getting closer to a state-like army, even though it's not yet at that stage, than even the regime's own security forces.
In terms of outside support, I mean, there have been so many outside actors, and we heard it obviously there from that chap in Aleppo just saying he fears what may now ensue with the Russian Air Force, with the Iranians and so forth. Are there outside backers for HDS or its fellow riders?
The obvious actor is Turkey, but we have to be careful also when considering the Turkish role. Turkey has been coordinating to some extent with HTS and some other faction, but it's by no means a strategic relation or something of a proxy relationship between them. They have shared interests, so Turkey provides some support, but it's still very, very limited. Most of the restructuring of the armed forces, of the armed opposition, has been something that they've done by themselves with only little support from outside actors.
Does that mean that we could potentially see Kurdish militants fighting on the, in effect on the same side as the Assad forces against the proxies? Well, you say they're not quite proxies, but the forces whom the Turks are backing.
I think the Kurdish militants are going to find their own ways. One of the issues is that they used to control one neighborhood in Aleppo, but they're not able anymore to control this place because of the strength of the armed opposition. So for them, the most logical choice is to negotiate some evacuation, to go more in the eastern part of the country where they are still strong, as opposed to simply allying with the regime. For them, it's like a temporary retreat while waiting for what next.
We're talking about the north of the country. Do you think there's any chance that those opposition forces, for example, in the suburbs of Damascus, in Dera, that they may rise up and cause a problem for Assad?
It has happened to some extent in Dera. There have been clashes. There have been armed opposition trying to seize weapons again and to try to fight back the regime forces. But they're not really well cohesive or well organized. But it's still a threat to the regime because it forces the regime to keep some troops in the south, to send people to the south that can't be sent to the north either. So this is a real destabilizing factor for it.
Jérôme Drevon, we'll leave it there. So many more questions to ask you. I'm sure we'll be having you back on the programme before long. But it is a fascinating, fast-paced and, as I said, difficult to predict exactly where this goes. But this frozen conflict, or what we conflict that we'd said had been frozen for so long, it does feel as if it is heating up very fast. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. Coming up on the programme, talks in South Korea aimed at negotiating a global deal to reduce plastic pollution have appeared to have failed. We'll hear from one man representing the plastics industry who is at the talks on why he and his colleagues believe that waste management is the answer to handling plastic pollution.
The beauty of this challenge, unlike some other environmental challenges like climate change and some other things, is that this is solvable. All of the technologies that exist out there today can be used to recycle all of the plastics that are out there.
More on that in 30 minutes. Headline this hour from the BBC newsroom. The United Nations is suspending aid deliveries in Gaza because it says its convoys are being looted by armed gangs. We'll be hearing from our correspondent in Jerusalem in just over 10 minutes. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. We've talked a lot recently about the fighting between Ukraine and Russia, but what about those places in Ukraine which did see intense combat at the start of the war and which are now under Russian control? The coastal city of Mariupol, down in the southeast of Ukraine, was the site, you may remember, of a particularly ferocious battle in early 2022. The Russians absolutely pounding and besieging the place into submission. What's it like now? Javier Cuesta is the Moscow-based correspondent for the Spanish newspaper El País, and he's just returned from a trip to Mariupol. What did he see?
Yes, I traveled to Mariupol from November 14th to 17th. There were two of us, one Italian journalist and I. Mariupol is Russian. The Russian government is rebuilding Mariupol. You can see several neighborhoods that were complete rebuilt, but other places are empty. They are destroyed till now. I don't know how many people live there. Before the war, alive about 400,000 people in Mariupol. But I can say that in the center, in the main center, you can see a lot of people. A lot of them are from Russia. Workers, they are military, they are people who comes from Russia. But local people, I can't say how many, but in airports, they are a building. No? For example, they rebuild the buildings and they are empty. Maybe one, two families live there only.
Oh, that's very interesting. So what you're saying is that, I mean, obviously it is difficult to tell when you're just somewhere for a short period of time, but you got the impression that there were lots of new immigrants from Russia who had come to Mariupol.
Yes, yes. And the local people tell us that the situation now, no, they come from not only from Russia, also from Central Asia, immigrant workers to rebuild the city. Russia is focusing in rebuild Mariupol. Is the place where a lot of money is going to rebuild the city in difference with other places. No, for example, I was in Donetsk under Russian control for 10 years. It's not destroyed like Mariupol, but the war didn't reach the city. But a lot of buildings, a lot of factories are closed there and they are not investing a lot of money in Donetsk. Right. But in Mariupol, yes.
And yes. Of course, I mean, we all remember from the early days of the war that the extraordinary levels of destruction that were visited on Mariupol as the Russians sort of pounded it to try and gain control. Did the locals who you were able to talk to, did they speak about that reconstruction? I mean, was it something that they welcomed? What did they think of it?
It's important to say that we were able to travel freely by Mariupol and speak with the people in the streets. The Russian authorities grant us the access to the territory. It's separate from Russian territory by checkpoints, but it was an press tour. We speak with people in the streets and they speak more or less openly. Of course, they are living under Russian control. This issue is the war was 2 years ago and still continues. But local people, they more or less speak openly. For example, I visit Nevsky district, the first place rebuilt by the Russian authorities. And Putin visited it 1 year ago. And people, they were afraid to tell me that the reconstruction is under very bad quality. The building's pretty outside, but the interior is not very good. Everything is plastic. They have a lot of issues because the quality is very bad. And they complain also about the situation. They say that they didn't speak a word. They didn't need to be liberated. They live quiet and they have a normal life before the war. And for example, a lot of them recognize that they lost everything that they had. And now they are trying to survive, get into the new situation, but they are not very happy. Of course, there are also local pro-Russian people who support the war, but their complaints, for example, were they couldn't travel with a Russian driving license by Ukraine. They complain about several issues with the language. For example, they couldn't speak Russian in several magazines. But in general, almost all the people, they say that they didn't speak the war. It's like a nightmare, like a dream. One day they were living a normal life, and the next day the war reached the city. They lose everything, and they only want peace and quiet.
And what about outside Mariupol, Javier? Were you able to see anywhere else, perhaps closer now to the front line?
Yes. Well, around Mariupol, a small village, they are destroyed and the people there come to Mariupol. This is the place where there is jobs, they can still live. But I also visit Gorlovka. Gorlovka is a city that were under Russian control for the last 10 years. The people who stay there support Russia, but they recognize that before the war, they didn't have big issues. It's interesting that when I visit Gorlovka, they suffered a power outage because the Ukraine army bombed one electric station and they lose energy for 1 week. People there recognize that it was the first time they suffered that, this big issue. Russian authorities say that about 60,000 people suffered this problem and the whole city were in dark after this attack.
Javier Cuesta now back from Mariupol in Moscow. According to people who follow these things, single people in their 20s are falling out of love with the apps that are supposed to find them love, or at least find them a date. And as dating apps decline in popularity, so the personal advertisement printed or posted online apparently refuses to die. The historian Francesca Bowman is the author of Shapely Ankle Preferred, A History of the Lonely Hearts Ad. She's been telling my colleague Paddy O'Connell where and when the ads began.
The world's first personal ad that we have evidence of was in 1695 in London. You can find it surrounded by an ad for a cobbler's apprentice and an Arabian stallion and a second-hand bed.
Could I have had all three if I'd wanted?
You could have had all three, plus the following. A gentleman about 30 years of age that says he has a very good estate would willingly match himself to some good young gentlewoman that has a fortune of £3,000 or thereabouts, and he will make settlement to content.
I'm sure we know that. And that 3,000 quid in those days would have been a fortune.
Well, absolutely. So you might slightly wonder about this gentleman's motives.
Can you read one that you think is achingly timeless?
One of my favourite personal ads was in the New York Times in 1903, and it said, "Young man, moderate circumstances, and who has a glass eye, would like to form the acquaintance of young girl who also has a glass eye. Girl must be respectable, money unnecessary, object matrimony." That has a timeless quality in that there's someone out there for everyone, right? You've just got to find them.
Is it clear that some people decide they need the same interests, the same outlook? Are some people trying to find someone who's different?
So I think that's changed over the centuries. In the 18th century, when these ads first emerged, there was a lot of openness about the economic basis of marriage and relationships. I think with the rise of individualism through the 19th century, you certainly get a bit more of an insight into what people have to offer, right? And they are a bit more like, I really like classical music, or I like cooking, or I want to live in the countryside. And you learn as much about the person advertising as you do as the person who answers it.
And so nowadays, the dating apps, have they killed the Lonely Hearts ads?
Personal ads in newspapers or magazines do still play a role because they're read by people in your community, right? They're read by somebody in the next town or someone nearby, which is the equivalent of, in the 18th century, you know, the boy at church or the girl who lived next door.
I wonder if they ever got together.
Let's hope. I think for a long time they absolutely did, but it's trickier these days.
Your book is called Shapely Ankle Preferred. What is the ad from which that's derived?
Oh, it's as simple as, man seeks wife, must have shapely ankle and good cow management skills. And that was a genuine 18th century ad, right? So let's all look for a woman who's got good cow management skills.
Hear, hear.
Paddy O'Connell, and he was speaking to Francesca Bowman. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Another major blow for the battered people of Gaza. The main UN relief agency for Palestinians has said today that it's halting the delivery of aid through a key crossing point between Israel and Gaza because of security concerns. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Nick Beek. Nick, tell me more.
Yeah, Tim, this is the Kerem Shalom crossing. It's really important because it is the route that the United Nations agency that looks after Palestinian refugees uses. But what they're saying today is the security situation has become so difficult there that they're suspending their deliveries, their trucks that would normally pass through. And the head of UNRWA has cited today what happened 2 weeks ago when about 100 trucks were looted. They were full of food. And also he makes the point that yesterday they tried again and 5 more lorries were intercepted. What's happening here, Tim, is that there are armed gangs and they are looking to see when the lorries are coming and they're moving in. A lot of the Palestinian lorry drivers are being injured. The UN, though, is saying that because Israel is occupying the Gaza Strip, it has a responsibility for the security there. It says that the siege that has been created is not helping this in any way at all, and says that a ceasefire would allow the uninterrupted flow of aid into Gaza. Israel hasn't so far responded to this, but certainly previously, the Israelis have said that they are facilitating the delivery of aid, they're helping trucks get through, and they've constantly rejected accusations that there isn't enough food in Gaza.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, the Israeli line presumably will remain that, you know, this just goes to show the failure of the relief agencies inside Gaza to sort this out. Presumably, that's only going to leave a vulnerable population even more vulnerable to the predations of hunger and winter.
Well, certainly that is the concern, and the head of UNRWA today was talking about what he described as a deteriorating situation, with hunger increasing as the 2.3 million people there go further into winter. They also point out that UNRWA is bringing in supplies, medicine, other sort of important things on behalf of other UN agencies, so the World Food Programme, UNICEF, the World Health Organization. So that is the concern. Israel does say that at the heart of this, it's poor management by the United Nations agencies, which, of course, Israel has deep concerns about in itself, specifically UNRWA. And they're saying that the situation there can be one where aid is distributed. So they have previously challenged a lot of the accusations leveled against them.
Nick Beek, our correspondent in Jerusalem, we'll leave it there for the time being. But certainly concerning news for people in Gaza that aid delivery point, Kerem Shalom, it's being closed temporarily by the UN because they say that they cannot guarantee the security of their drivers whom they're using to distribute aid within Gaza. This is NewsHour. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London with me, Tim Franks. The crisis in Georgia is deepening over who is running the country and what sort of links it should have with the West. There's been a third night of clashes between police and protesters, furious that the government has, they say, suspended talks on membership of the European Union, and furious, in fact, that the government is still in power. They insist, as does the current president of Georgia, that the Georgian Dream Party only won re-election in October through a rigged process. Anna Makarashvili is one of the demonstrators who's now encamped near the parliament.
What we're protecting here is our home and our children's future and our future. We're not going to stop. If they think that they're going to scare us by fight, we're not going to scare down. They kill us, more of us are going to come back. They punch us, more of us are going to come back. We are going to bring this fight to a conclusion, and we're going to get our country back.
Well, I mentioned that the protests are partly in response to the government's decision to pause Georgia's EU accession process. I'd say that. And today, there has nonetheless been a very strong rebuttal to that from the Prime Minister. He's been speaking to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, who's currently in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. Steve, I know we're going to hear your interview in a moment, but just in terms of the scene in the capital after another night of disturbances, what have you seen?
Three nights, yes, of huge protests. Three nights of protests being forcibly dispersed by the security forces here with water cannon and tear gas. And, you know, you wake up in the morning and the traffic is running as normal, everything feels normal, and then by the evening, thousands of people gather once again outside the parliament, and this is repeated. And as you mentioned, Tim, I've been speaking to Georgia's Prime Minister, Irakli Kobakhidze, to get sort of official reaction to what's been going on. And as you mentioned, it was his announcement last week that Georgia is suspending talks with the EU on becoming a member of the European Union until the end of 2028. It was that announcement that sparked the big protests on Thursday and sparked huge disappointment amongst Georgians. And there are many here who see the future of their country in Europe. Keep in mind, before we listen to this, that Mr. Kobakhidze really did make that announcement about suspending Georgia's EU bid. But when I put it to him that many Georgians are feeling betrayed by that decision, he seemed to have forgotten all about that. Let's listen.
The response is very clear. So we have not suspended anything related to the European integration. It's just a lie. And there are the opposition leaders, there are the media outlets linked with the opposition who are just lying to these people. But nobody has suspended the European integration of Georgia. We are very much committed to the European integration.
But you suspended until 2028?
No. We have said that during these 4 years, everything will be done in order to promote Georgia towards the European Union. We will fulfill more than 90% of our obligations, which derive from the association agenda and from the DCFTA. That's our very clear commitment. Nobody has suspended anything also until 2028. It's just a lie. It's the opposition and it's the opposition media outlets who are just lying to these people.
But you suspended this until 2028.
No, it's not true. It's not true. Even now I have said that if the European Union will make a decision about opening the accession talks, I will sign to it immediately. Nobody is suspending it. The only thing that we are saying is that it's not fair to the Georgian people to use the accession talks as a tool for blackmailing. It's not an honest approach. We are saying no to the blackmailing. That's it. But we are not suspending the European integration of Georgia until 2028 or whatever. We are committed to the European integration and we are continuing our path towards the European Union. And we will fulfill more than 90% of the obligations from the association agenda and from DCFTA exactly until 2028. So that's our very clear commitment.
But you know that the European Union has already accused Georgia and your government of backtracking on democracy.
Which is not true. It's just a lie. It's just a lie. So we are very frequently comparing Georgia with Moldova. You know that in Moldova, the level of corruption is extremely high. It's one of the most corrupted countries in Europe. The institutions are extremely weak. Only 45% of Moldovans residing in the country are supportive to the European integration. Moldova has not joined any sanctions to the Russian Federation. And Moldova is the member of the CIS, which is the key international community under the Russian umbrella. And nobody is criticizing Moldova. But these people are saying that we are backsliding in terms of democracy. Just lies. And of course, this kind of lies heavily damage the reputation of the European bureaucracy and the Georgian society. That's not good.
And finally, you must have seen the videos in social media of the brutal way in which the police have treated some of the protesters in the last few days. What is your reaction to that?
I have condemned this incidents several times, many times, and investigation will happen against this kind of incidents. But also in this case, it's important to have a clear position with regard to the violence from both sides. And I have to say that there was no systemic violence committed by the police during these days, but there was a very rough systemic violence committed by the opposition groups, violent groups, and nobody's condemning that.
The Prime Minister of Georgia, Irakli Kobakhidze, speaking to Russia editor Steve Rosenberg, who's in Tbilisi. And Steve, I mean, he did seem forthright on saying, look, we haven't actually suspended talks with the EU. They're just sort of not on the agenda. The other issue, though, is, of course, who's in charge in Georgia. I know you've been speaking to the president, who's got a rather different view of things.
Well, keep in mind, Tim, that the president in Georgia is largely a ceremonial figure, right? It doesn't have so much power. The current president is Salome Zurabishvili, and her mandate was due to end in December. But yesterday she said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to remain the president, because she considers basically that the institution of president in Georgia is the only legitimate institution left. She doesn't believe the parliament or the government is legitimate. So the prime minister today dismissed that rather mockingly. But on the question of where Georgia is heading and EU membership, keep in mind that for more than 20 years, Georgians have been told by successive governments here that their future lies in Europe, that the country is on the road to joining the EU, to joining NATO. And in fact, that ambition, that aspiration is enshrined in the constitution here. Now they've been told, nope, that's on hold for 4 years. That has sparked the disappointment and the anger, because polls show that the vast majority of Georgians, maybe 70, 80% of the population, does want a future inside the European Union.
That is striking. And just briefly, Steve, because of that, do you think there is a chance that these protests might spread elsewhere in Georgia?
Well, they are already spreading. There are reports of protests in several Georgian towns and cities. Where things go from here, it's not clear. As I say, we've had three nights of protest, major protest, and a lot of violence, and no sense that either side is about to back down.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor in Tbilisi, thanks ever so much for joining us. Tens of thousands of people attended a vigil last night in Beirut to commemorate the late Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, the first public ceremony to mark his killing in an Israeli airstrike 2 months ago. Across Lebanon, people are still going back to their homes as the ceasefire holds. In the south, amid widespread destruction, Hezbollah supporters remain defiant, claiming that they have been the victors, from the war with Israel. Our Middle East correspondent Uga Bashega has this report.
As they return home, they also bury their dead, fighters celebrated here as heroes of the resistance. Hezbollah flags, too many to count, are flown high, proudly, at this funeral in the village of Marrakech.
This is more than a funeral. This is a show of strength and support for Hezbollah. And whoever thinks they will go away, well, from what we're seeing here, this is unlikely to happen.
The group has been weakened by Israel. Some say humiliated, but it hasn't been destroyed. Reem Mohammed Zayoun was watching the procession go by.
You say that this is victory, but how can it be victory with so much destruction and suffering?
I think to be free from Israelis people, this is alone a victory to me, because they killed many people in Lebanon.
How do you see Hezbollah now? Weakened, stronger?
Strong. They're still strong. Whenever God is with us, we are strong. I'm very satisfied with God's will and what God wants for us.
If there is defiance, there's also desolation. Street after street we visited, almost nothing was left untouched by the war. Destroyed homes and businesses, lost memories. We find Kamel, who's only 18. He's searching through the rubble with his bare hands, trying to save whatever he can find.
All my memories are here, house of my grandpa. I don't have anything right now. No problem. We do memory again. No problem.
You're going to rebuild?
Yes. No problem.
Please.
So this is the city. Yes, yes, we're going.
At all times, we had to be guided by Hezbollah minders, a sign they're still very much in control here. They took us on a tour of Tyre city centre to see the destruction caused by weeks of Israeli airstrikes. Yasser Kassem was cleaning up his shop.
I left the war here. Yeah, we were opening for the first days. Then it was so difficult to still open. Then we closed everything. We got out of the city. And today we are back.
And what is going to happen next?
Looking for friends, for families, for neighbors, for our beloved. Yeah.
Do you know anyone who's been killed?
Many. Yeah, we lost many friends. Look around. This is not Tyre that we know.
We've also been taken to this water pumping station, which used to serve 30,000 homes. Now, it's also destroyed. And joining this tour, organized by Hezbollah, is one of its MPs, Hossein Jashi.
The Zionist enemy is resourceful and supported by the US. Their aim was to destroy the resistance and create a new Middle East. The fact that the enemy failed to achieve the targets they set means that we are victorious.
This narrative will be embraced by Hezbollah followers, but will find no support elsewhere. 4,000 people across the country have been killed and more than 16,000 injured. With so much death and destruction, is this really a victory?
Uga Bashega on the long and big cleanup in Lebanon. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. Everyone agrees that waste from plastics is a scourge which threatens our oceans and our planet. The big question is what to do about it. Today was supposed to be the last day of the final international summit to get a global agreement on plastic pollution. It seems the negotiations may have collapsed. The chair of the talks in South Korea has just said more time is needed. More than 170 countries have been taking part in the summit. We'll hear from a senior person in the plastics industry in a moment. But first, our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher, is here in the NewsHour studio with me. Jonah, what has happened?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the talks have failed. This is the final day of what's supposed to have been a two-year process leading up to this, well, what was supposed to be a globally legally binding treaty to tackle plastic pollution. As you said there, there's a plenary session, the closing session of that meeting in South Korea going on at the moment. It is very clear that there will not be an agreement. Divisions in particular over cuts to plastic production seem to have scuppered the talks. I think the real question now is, will there be another round possibly next year, or has the experience been so scarring that they decide that it's simply not feasible to bring everyone together in this sort of huge setting again and think that they might be able to get everyone to agree?
You've talked about the sort of the philosophical, the ideological dividing lines. Is it possible to say sort of who is lining up where?
Yeah, many of the countries, and we're talking over 100, have signed up to the idea of cutting plastic production as a concept. At the moment, you know, the world in general produces more than 400 million tons of plastic, of which about half of it is only used once or so. And then there has been a group, and it's been the same throughout this process with 2 years long, a group of oil-producing countries. Plastic is primarily made from fossil fuels. That group includes Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, India. And that group has throughout been very firm that it does not want a mention of restrictions on how much plastic is made and indeed chemicals that are going to be used in those plastics to be part of the talks. And that's where how we got to today, which is effectively the breakdown of talks, because the ambitious countries have been saying, well, if we don't have cuts in production, and you know, this isn't going to be meaningful for any of us. Whereas on the other side, you have this group of oil producing countries who have been very firm that they weren't willing to consider any mention of that in the treaty. And so the net result is, well, the breakdown of the talks in South Korea and some pretty big questions as to whether it's worth coming back or whether indeed it's better for our planet if those people who want to cut production in a serious way proceed without involving perhaps this group of oil producers who have, well, over the last week, it's been pretty clear, have been trying to slow down and scupper these talks.
Jonah Fisher, for the time being, thank you. The difference of opinion does seem to boil down to, is it all about improving our recycling of plastic? That's certainly the feeling as far as the manufacturers are concerned, or whether a cap, as Jonah was mentioning, should be put on the production of plastic. Ross Eisenberg is president of America's Plastic Makers. He's at the American Chemistry Council. He's been pushing for the waste management idea in Busan, where the talks have been happening. I asked him how they can claim to want to help curb plastic pollution if they won't even consider a cap on production.
Well, we're investing heavily in our own industry and in recycling and in reuse and in designing products better in order to solve this problem. I mean, the beauty of this challenge, unlike some other environmental challenges like climate change and some other things, is that this is solvable. All of the technologies that exist out there today can be used to recycle all the plastics that are out there.
But they're very expensive, though, aren't they, Ross?
They're expensive, but I think that capital comes off of the sidelines if you start having some, you know, some sort of incentive or at least certainty that money will actually be worthwhile. So a CEO of one of our member companies tells me all the time, he said, look, it would take us $200 or $300 million to invest in a new facility to do what we call advanced recycling, chemical recycling, to take some of those hard to recycle plastics out. And they're willing to do it, but he has to, you know, justify that to his shareholders that the investment's worth it. And that means that the rules of the road will be consistent. He'll be able to permit that facility and he'll actually be able to operate it. And so what we want is to create a policy environment where the answer to that question is yes, so that that capital comes off the sidelines and the shareholders say, yeah, that's a good idea to invest in.
And what do you say to those who say that actually recycling is sort of too far down the pipeline of problem here, in that there's a lot about plastics that we do not know in terms of the harms that they cause, or that we fear that we're barely scratching the surface of, for example, the pollution from microplastics that goes into the environment and can't be recycled away, and the chemicals that go into the making of plastics, half of which we simply haven't tested for their possible health problems. How can you reassure people that that is, you know, that is something that they should not worry about?
Yeah, I mean, so it's worth talking about what we call the concept of circularity. So circularity is more than just recycling. It's designing products better. It's reusing them, right? Recycling is actually farther down the chain, right? The waste hierarchy says reduce, reuse, recycle. So you should look to reduce it where possible. You should look to reuse plastics when possible and then recycle them if those other two don't work. When it comes to microplastics, this is a concept that we are studying, that the governmental bodies are studying. The WHO has said that for now it does not pose a significant risk, but obviously needs to be continued to be studied.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. You talked about the aim in terms of reducing waste and pollution. I guess one of the issues for you is that, given that you are president of America's plastic makers, I mean, in a sense, that's a recipe for smaller profits, really, because if you genuinely do end up producing less, then inevitably it's going to cut into your colleagues' plastic manufacturers' profit margins, isn't it?
You know, it's an interesting concept, but I think that the business model changes, right? You know, this is an industry that, and one of the beauties of the plastics industry, which is essentially the chemical industry, is that they're chemical engineers, so they don't run away from their problems. They tend to innovate around them. But this is one where I think you're seeing business models change in real time. So if we get to a point where circularity is the dominant, you know, is sort of how this is done, then you're still making plastics. You're just making them out of the feedstock that you're using is no longer oil and gas. It's used plastic. Some of these plastic makers become plastic recyclers, which is a different business model for them. But it's a business model that we think is the path forward.
And that was Ross Eisenberg, president of America's Plastic Makers, speaking to me from Busan, where those talks on curbing plastic pollution do seem to have collapsed after, as we were hearing from our environment correspondent Jonah Fisher, years of talks. That's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.